to steer. She'd brought no foul weather gear, no food, no water. Finally, the fear came from a place deeper than the sea. Fear from knowing she would be alone again, probably always, a life sentence. Ugly, gasping noises passed from her throat as the boat skewed and rolled broadside, tipping dangerously with each wave. By now, 6 inches of foamy water covered the floor of the boat, burning her bare feet with its cold. How quickly the sea and clouds defeated the spring heat. Folding one arm over her chest, she tried to warm herself as she steered weakly with the other hand, not fighting the water, just moving with it. At last, the waters calmed. And although the current swept her along to its own purpose, the ocean no longer thrashed and churned. Up ahead, she saw a small elongated sandbar, maybe 100 feet long, glistening with sea and wet shells. Fighting the strong underflow, and just at the right second, Kaya jerked the tiller and turned out of the current. She steered around to the leeward side of the bar, and in the stiller waters, beached as gently as a first kiss. She stepped onto the narrow slip and sank to the sand, lay back and felt the solid land against her. She knew it wasn't Chase she mourned, but a life defined by rejections. As the sky and clouds struggled overhead, she said out loud, "I have to do life alone. But I knew this. I've known a long time that people don't stay." It hadn't been a coincidence that Chase slyly mentioned marriage as bait, immediately bedded her, then dropped her for someone else. She knew from her studies that males go from one female to the next. So why had she fallen for this man? His fancy ski boat was the same as the pumped-up neck and outsized antlers of a buck deer in rut, appendages to ward off other males and attract one female after another. Yet she had fallen for the same ruse as Ma. Leapfrogging sneaky fuckers. What lies had Pa told her? To what expensive restaurants had he taken her before his money gave out, and he brought her home to his real territory, a swamp shack? Perhaps love is best left as a fallow field. Speaking out loud, she recited an Amanda Hamilton poem. "I must let go now. Let you go. Love is too often the answer for staying, too seldom the reason for going. I drop the line and watch you drift away. All along, you thought the fiery current of your lover's breast pulled you to the deep. But it was my heart tide releasing you to float adrift with seaweed." The weak sun found space between the heavy-bottomed clouds and touched the sandbar. Kaya looked around. The current, the grand sweep of the sea, and this sand had conspired as a delicate catch net. Because all around her lay the most astonishing collection of shells she'd ever seen. The angle of the bar and its gentle flow gathered the shells on the leeward side and laid them gently upon the sand without breaking them. She spotted several rare ones and many of her favorites, intact and pearly, still glistening. Moving among them, she chose the most precious and stashed them in a pile. She flipped the boat, drained the water, and lined the shells carefully along the bottom seam. Now she planned her trip back by standing tall and studying the waters. She read the sea, and having learned from the shells, would embark from the leeward side and head straight for land from here, avoiding the strongest current altogether. As she pushed off, she knew no one would ever see this sandbar again. The elements had created a brief and shifting smile of sand, angled just so. The next tide, the next current, would design another sandbar and another, but never this one. Not the one who caught her. The one who told her a thing or two. Later, wandering her beach, she recited her favorite Amanda Hamilton poem. Fading moon, follow my footsteps through light unbroken by land shadows, and share my senses that feel the cool shoulders of silence. Only you know how one side of a moment is stretched by loneliness, for miles to the other edge, and how much sky is in one breath when time slides backward from the sand. If anyone understood loneliness, the moon would. Drifting back to the predictable cycles of tadpoles and the ballet of fireflies, Kaya burrowed deeper into the wordless wilderness. Nature seemed the only stone that would not slip midstream. Chapter 31. A Book. 1968. The rusted-out mailbox, mounted on a pole Pa cut, stood at the end of the road that had no name. Kaya's only mail was bulk postings sent to all residents. She had no bills to pay, no girlfriends or old aunts to send silly sweet notes. Except for that one letter from Ma years ago, her mail was a neutral thing, and sometimes she wouldn't empty the box for weeks. But in her 22nd year, more than a year after Chase and Pearl announced their engagement, she walked the sandy lane, blistering with heat, to the mailbox every day and looked inside. Finally, one morning, she found a bulky manila envelope and slid the contents, an advance copy of The Seashells of the Eastern Seaboard by Catherine Danielle Clark, into her hands. She breathed in. No one to show it to. Sitting on her beach, she looked at every page. When Kaya had written to the publisher after Tate's initial contact and submitted more drawings, they sent her a contract by return mail. Because all her paintings and text for each shell sample had been completed for years, her editor, Mr. Robert Foster, wrote to her that the book would be published in record time, and that her second on birds would follow soon after. He included an advance payment of $5,000. Pa would have tripped over his gimpy leg and spilled his poke. Now, in her hands, the final copy. Every brush stroke, every carefully thought-out color, every word of the natural histories printed in a book. There were also drawings of the creatures who live inside. How they eat, how they move, how they mate. Because people forget about creatures who live in shells. She touched the pages and remembered each shell and the story of finding it. Where it lay on the beach, the season, the sunrise. A family album. Over the coming months, up and down the coasts of North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Virginia, Florida, and New England, gift shops and bookstores put her book in their windows or on display tables. The royalty checks would come in every 6 months, they said, and might be several $1,000s each. Sitting at the kitchen table, she drafted a letter of thanks to Tate. But as she read it over, her heart paused. A note did not seem enough. Because of his kindness, her love of the marsh could now be her life's work. Her life. Every feather, shell, or insect she collected could be shared with others, and no longer would she have to dig through mud for her supper. Might not have to eat grits every day. Jumpin' had told her Tate was working as an ecologist at the new institute and laboratory near Sea Oaks, which had assigned him a spiffed-up research boat. At times, she'd seen him in the distance, but steered clear. She added a postscript to the note.
If you're near my place sometime, stop by. I'd like to give you a copy of the book.
And addressed it to him at the lab. The next week, she hired a fix-it man, Jerry, who put in running water, a water heater, and a full bathroom with a clawfoot tub in the back bedroom. He set a sink in a cabinet topped with tiles and installed a flush toilet. Electricity was brought in, and Jerry put in a range and new refrigerator. Kaya insisted on keeping the old wood stove, firewood piled next to it, because it heated the shack. But mostly because it had baked 1,000 biscuits from her mother's heart. What if Ma came back and her stove was gone? He made kitchen cabinets of heart pine, hung a new front door, a new screen on the porch, and made shelves for her specimens from floor to ceiling. She ordered a sofa, chairs, beds, mattresses, and rugs from Sears Roebuck, but kept the old kitchen table. And now she had a real closet to store a few mementos, a little scrap closet of her fallen-away family. As before, the shack stood unpainted on the outside, the weathered pine boards and tin roof rich in gray and rust colors, brushed by Spanish moss from the overhanging oak. Less rickety, but still woven into the weft of the marsh. Kaya continued sleeping on the porch, except in the coldest of winter. But now she had a bed. One morning, Jumpin' told Kaya developers were coming to the area with big plans to drain the murky swamp and build hotels. Now and then, over the last year, she'd seen large machines cutting entire stands of oaks in a week, then digging channels to dry the marsh. When finished, they moved on to new spots, leaving tracks of thirst and hardpan behind. Apparently, they had not read Aldo Leopold's book. A poem by Amanda Hamilton said it clearly. Child to child, eye to eye, we grew as one, sharing souls, wing by wing, leaf by leaf. You left this world. You died before the child, my friend, the wild. Kaya didn't know if her family owned the land or just squatted it, as had most marsh people for four centuries. Over the years, searching for clues of Ma's whereabouts, she'd read every scrap of paper in the shack and had never seen anything like a deed. As soon as she got home from Jumpin's, she wrapped the old Bible in a cloth and took it to the Bartley Cove courthouse. The county clerk, a white-haired man with an enormous forehead and tiny shoulders, brought out a large leather volume of records, some maps, and a few aerial photographs, which he spread on the counter. Running her finger across the map, Kaya pointed out her lagoon and outlined the rough boundaries of what she thought of as her land. The clerk checked the reference number and searched for the deed in an old wooden filing cabinet.
"Yep, here it is," he said. "It were surveyed proper and bought up in 1897 by a Mr. Napier Clark."
"That's my grandpa," Kaya said. She thumbed through the thin pages of the Bible, and there, in the records of births and deaths, was one Napier Murphy Clark. Such a grand name. The same as her brother's. She told the clerk her pa was dead, which he probably was.
"It's ne'er been sold, so yessiree, bobtail, I reckon it belongs to you. But I'm afraid to tell you, there's some back taxes, Miss Clark, and to keep the land, you gotta pay 'em. In fact, ma'am, the way the law reads, whoever comes along and pays off them back taxes owns the land even if they don't got no deed."
"How much?"
Kaya had not opened a bank account, and all the cash she owned after the improvements to her house, some $3,000, was right in her knapsack. But they must be talking 40 years of back taxes, thousands and thousands of dollars.
"Well, let's looky here. It's listed as wasteland category, so taxes for most of them years was about $5. Let's see here. I gotta calculate it."
He stepped over to a fat and clunky adding machine, punched in numbers, and after every entry, pulled back the crank handle, which made a churning sound as if it were actually summing up.
Looks like it'll be about $800 total. Put the land free and clear.
Kaya walked out of the courthouse with a full deed in her name for 310 acres of lush lagoons, sparkling marsh, oak forests, and a long private beach on the North Carolina coastline. Wasteland category, murky swamp. Pulling back into her lagoon at dusk, she had a talk with the heron.
It's all right. That spot's yourn.
The next noon, there was a note from Tate in her mailbox, which seemed strange and somehow formal, since he'd only ever left messages for her on the feather stump. He thanked her for the invitation to stop by her place for a copy of her book, and added that he'd be there that very afternoon. Carrying one of the 6 copies of her new book the publishers had given her, she waited on the old reading log. In about 20 minutes, she heard the sound of Tate's old boat chugging up the channel and stood. As he eased into view from the undergrowth, they waved and smiled softly. Both guarded. The last time he'd pulled in here, she'd hurled rocks in his face. After tying up, Tate stepped up to her.
Kaya, your book is a wonder.
He leaned slightly forward as if to hug her, but the hardened rinds of her heart held her back. Instead, she handed him the book.
Here, Tate. This is for you.
Thank you, Kaya,
he said as he opened it and paged through. He didn't mention that, of course, he'd already bought one at the Sea Oaks bookshelf and marveled at every page.
Nothing like this has ever been published. I'm sure this is just a beginning for you.
She simply bowed her head and smiled slightly. Then, turning to the title page, he said,
Oh, you haven't signed it. You have to inscribe it for me. Please.
She jerked her head up at him.
Had not thought of that.
What words could she possibly write to Tate? He took a pen from his jeans pocket and handed it to her. She took it, and after a few seconds wrote,
To the Feather Boy, thank you, from the Marsh Girl.
Tate read the words, then turned away, staring far across the marsh because he couldn't hold her. Finally, he lifted her hand and squeezed it.
Thank you, Kaya.
It was you, Tate.
She said, and then thought,
It was always you.
One side of her heart longing, the other shielding. He stood for a minute, and when she didn't say more, he turned to go. But as he got into his boat, he said,
Kaya, when you see me out in the marsh, please don't hide in the grass like a spotted fawn. Just call out to me and we can do some exploring together. Okay?
All right.
Thanks again for the book.
Goodbye, Tate.
She watched until he disappeared in the thicket and then said,
I could have at least invited him in for tea.
That wouldn't hurt anything. I could be his friend.
Then, with rare pride, she thought of her book.
I could be his colleague.
An hour after Tate left, Kaya motored to Jumpin's Wharf, another copy of her book tucked in her knapsack. As she approached, she saw him leaning against the wall of his weathered shop. He stood and waved to her, but she did not wave back. Knowing something was different, he waited silently as she tied up. She stepped up to him, lifted his hand, and put the book in his palm. At first, he didn't understand, but she pointed to her name and said,
I'm okay now, Jumpin'.
Thank you, and thank Mabel for all you did for me.
He stared at her. In another time and place, an old black man and a young white woman might have hugged, but not there, not then. She covered his hand with hers, turned, and motored away. It was the first time she'd seen him speechless. She kept on buying gas and supplies from him, but never accepted a handout from them again. And each time she came to his wharf, she saw her book propped up in the tiny window for all to see, as a father would have shown it. Chapter 32 Alibi, 1969. Low, dark clouds raced over a steel sea toward Barclay Cove. The wind hit first, rattling windows and hurling waves over the wharf. Boats, tied to the dock, bobbed up and down like toys, as men in yellow slickers tied this line or that, securing. Then sideways rain slammed the village, obscuring everything except the odd yellow form moving about in the grayness. The wind whistled through the sheriff's window, and he raised his voice.
"So, Joe, you had something to tell me?" "Sure do. I find out where Miss Clark will claim she was the night Chase died." "What? Did you finally catch up to her?" "You kidding? She's slipperier than a damn eel. Gets gone every time I get near. So I drove over to Jumpin's Marina this morning to see if he knew when she'd be coming next. Like everybody else, she has to go there for gas, so I figured I'd catch her up sooner or later. You won't believe what I found out." "Let's have it." "I got two reliable sources say she was out of town that night." "What? Who?" "She never goes out of town. And even if she did, who'd know about it?" "You remember Tate Walker? Dr. Walker now? Works out at the new ecology lab." "Yeah, I know him. His dad's a shrimper. Scupper Walker." "Well, Tate says he knew Kaya, he calls her Kaya, quite well when they were younger." "Oh? Not like that, they were just kids. He taught her to read, apparently." "He tell you this himself?" "Yep, he was there at Jumpin's. I was asking Jumpin' if he knew where or how I could ask the Marsh girl some questions. He said he didn't know from one minute to the next when he'd see her. Jumpin's always been good to her. Doubt if he'll tell us much. Well, I asked him if by any chance he knew what she was doing the night Chase died. And he said that, as a matter of fact, he did. That she'd come to his place the second morning after Chase died, and that he was the very one who told her he was dead. He said she'd been in Greenville for two nights, including the night Chase died." "Greenville?" "That's what he said. And then Tate, who'd been standing there all that time, he piped in and said, yeah, she'd been in Greenville. That he was the one who told her how to buy the bus ticket." "Well, that is some news," Sheriff Jackson said. "And very convenient that they were both standing there with the same story. Why would she go over to Greenville?" "Tate said that a publishing company, you know she's gone and written a book on shells and one of seabirds. Well, they paid her expenses to go over there and meet him." "Hard to imagine fancy publishing people wanting to meet her. I guess it'll be pretty easy to check out. What did Tate say about teaching her to read?" "I asked him how he knew her. He said he used to go out near her place to fish. And when he found out she couldn't read, he taught her." That's so," Joe said. "Anyway, this changes everything. She does have an alibi, a good one. I'd say being in Greenville's a pretty good alibi." "Yeah, on the surface. You know what they say about good alibis? And we got that shrimper saying he saw her boating directly toward the fire tower the very night Chase fell off it." "He could have been wrong. It was dark. No moon until after 2 a.m. Maybe she was in Greenville and he saw somebody else out there in a boat looks like hers." "Well, like I said, This supposed trip to Greenville should be easy to check out.
The storm abated into a whine and drizzle. Still, instead of walking to the diner, the two lawmen sent a runner for a takeout of chicken and dumplings, butter beans, summer squash casserole, cane syrup, and biscuits. Right after lunch, a knock sounded on the sheriff's door. Miss Pansy Price opened it and stepped inside. Joe and Ed stood. Her turban hat glistened a rose color.
"Afternoon, Miss Pansy."
Both nodded.
"Good afternoon, Ed. Joe, may I have a seat? I won't take long. I believe I have important information concerning the case."
"Yes, of course. Sit down, please."
The two men sat as soon as Miss Pansy settled like a fair-sized hen into the chair, tucking feathers here and there, her pocketbook perching on her lap like a prized egg. The sheriff, continuing, couldn't resist.
"And what case would that be, Miss Pansy?"
"Oh, for heaven's sake, Ed, you know what case. Who murdered Chase Andrews? That case."
"We don't know if he was murdered, Miss Pansy." "All right. Now, what do you have for us?"
"As you know, I'm employed at Cress's."
She never lowered her standing by referring to the entire name, Cress's Five and Dime. She waited for the sheriff to acknowledge her comment with a nod, even though they all knew she'd worked there since she sold toy soldiers to him as a boy, and then continued.
"I believe the Marsh girl is a suspect. Is that correct?"
"Who told you that?"
"Oh, lots of people are convinced, but Patty Love's the main source."
"I see."
"Well, from Cress's, me and some other employees saw the Marsh girl get on and off the bus on days that would have put her out of town the night Chase died. I can testify to those dates and times."
"That so?"
Joe and Ed exchanged glances.
"What are the dates and times?"
Miss Pansy sat straighter in her chair.
"She left on the 2:30 p.m. bus on October 28th and returned at 1:16 on the 30th.
"You said others saw her, too?"
"Yes. I can get a list if you like."
"That won't be necessary. We'll come over to the Five and Dime if we want statements." "Thank you, Miss Pansy."
The sheriff stood. So Miss Pansy and Ed did as well. She moved toward the door.
"Well, thank you for your time. As you said, you know where to find me."
They said goodbyes. Joe sat back down.
"Well, there it is. Confirms what Tate and Jumpin said. She was in Greenville that night. Or leastwise, she got on a bus and went somewheres."
The sheriff blew out a long breath.
"Appears so. But I reckon if somebody can bus over to Greenville by day, they can bus back here at night, do their business, bus back to Greenville. Nobody the wiser." "I guess. Seems a bit of a stretch. Go get the bus schedules. We'll see if the times work out. If a return trip is possible in one night."
Before Joe stepped out, Ed continued.
"Could be she wanted to be seen out there in broad daylight getting on and off of buses. When you think about it, she had to do something out of the ordinary for an alibi. To claim that she'd been alone in her shack the night Chase died, as she usually is, would be no alibi at all. Zip. So she planned up something that lots of people would see her do. Making a great alibi right in front of all those folks on Main Street. Brilliant." "Well, yeah, that's a good point. Anyhow, we don't have to play gumshoe anymore. We can sit right here drinking coffee and let the ladies of this town waltz in and out of here with all the goods. I'll go get the bus schedules."
Joe returned 15 minutes later.
"Well, you're right," he said. See here, it would be possible to bus from Greenville to Barkley Cove and then back again all in one night. Easy, really. Yeah, plenty of time between the two buses to push somebody off the fire tower. I say we get a warrant.
Chapter 33 The Scar, 1968. In the winter of 1968, Kaya sat at her kitchen table one morning, sweeping orange and pink watercolors across paper, creating the plump form of a mushroom. She had finished her book on seabirds and now worked on a guide to mushrooms. Already had plans for another on butterflies and moths. Black-eyed peas, red onions, and salt ham boiled in the old dented pot on the wood stove, which she still preferred to the new range, especially in winter. The tin roof sang under a light rain. Then, suddenly the sounds of a truck laboring through sand came down her lane, rumbling louder than the roof. Panic rising, she stepped to the window and saw a red pickup maneuvering the muddy ruts. Kaya's first thought was to run, but the truck was already pulling up to the porch. Hunched down below the window sill, she watched a man in a gray-green military uniform step out. He just stood there, truck door ajar, looking through the woods, down the path toward the lagoon. Then, closing the door softly, he jogged through the rain to the porch door and knocked. She cussed. He was probably lost, would ask directions and go on, but she didn't want to deal with him. She could hide here in the kitchen, hope he went away. But she heard him call, "Yo, anybody home? Hello?" Annoyed, yet curious, she walked through the newly furnished sitting room to the porch. The stranger, tall with dark hair, stood on the front step holding the screen door open, 5 feet from her. His uniform seemed stiff enough to stand on its own, as if it were holding him together. The breast of his jacket was covered with colorful rectangular medals. But most eye-catching of all was a jagged red scar that cut his face in half from his left ear to the top of his lips. Kaya gasped. In an instant, she returned to the Easter Sunday about 6 months before Ma left for good. Singing Rock of Ages, she and Ma walked arm in arm through the sitting room to the kitchen and gathered up the brilliantly colored eggs they had painted the night before. The other kids were out fishing, so she and Ma had time to hide the eggs, then get the chicken and biscuits into the oven. The brothers and sisters were too old to hunt for treats, but they would run around searching, pretending not to find them, then holding each discovered treasure high in the air, laughing. Ma and Kaya were leaving the kitchen with their baskets of eggs and chocolate bunnies from the Five and Dime, just as Pa rounded the corner from the hall. Yanking Kaya's Easter bonnet from her head and waving it around, he screamed at Ma, "Where you get the money for these fancy things? Bonnets and shiny leather shoes? Them prissy eggs and chocolate bunnies? Say, where?"
"Come on, Jake. Please hush. It's Easter. This is for the kids."
He shoved Ma backward.
"You out whoring, that's what. That how you get the money? Tell me now."
He grabbed Ma by the arms and shook her so hard, her face seemed to rattle around her eyes, which stayed very still and wide open. Eggs tumbled from the basket and rolled in wobbly pastels across the floor.
"Pa, please, stop!"
Kaya cried out, then sobbed. He lifted his hand and slapped Kaya hard across the cheek.
"Shut up, you prissy pot crybaby. Get that silly-looking dress and fancy shoes off you. Them's whoring clothes."
She ducked down, holding her face, chasing after Ma's hand-painted eggs.
"I'm talking to you, woman. Where are you getting your money?"
He lifted the iron fire poker from the corner and moved toward Ma. Kaya screamed as loud as she could and grabbed at Pa's arm as he slammed the poker across Ma's chest. Blood popped out on the flowery sundress like red polka dots. Then a big body moved down the hall, and Kaya looked up to see Jody tackle Pa from behind, sending them both sprawling across the floor. Her brother got between Ma and Pa and hollered for Kaya and Ma to run, and they did. But before she turned, Kaya saw Pa raise the poker and whack Jody across the face, his jaw twisting grossly, blood spewing. The scene played out in her mind now in a flash. Her brother crumbling onto the floor, lying among purple-pink eggs and chocolate bunnies. She and Ma running through palmettos, hiding in brush. Her dress bloody, Ma kept saying it was fine, the eggs wouldn't break, and they could still cook the chicken. Kaya didn't understand why they stayed hidden there. She was sure her brother was dying, needed their help, but she was too afraid to move. They waited for a long time and then snuck back, looking through the windows to make sure Pa was gone. Jody lay cold on the floor, blood pooled around him, and Kaya cried that he was dead. But Ma aroused him and moved him to the sofa, where she stitched up his face with her sewing needle. When all was quiet, Kaya snatched her bonnet from the floor and ran fast through the woods and threw it with all her might into the sawgrass. Now, she looked into the eyes of the stranger standing on her porch and said, "Jody." He smiled, the scar going crooked, and replied,
"Kaya, I hoped you'd be here."
They stared, each searching for the other in older eyes. Jody couldn't know he had been with her all these years, that scores of times he had shown her the way through the marsh, taught her over and over about herons and fireflies. More than anyone else, she had wanted to see Jody or Ma again. Her heart had erased the scar and all the pain in that package. No wonder her mind buried the scene. No wonder Ma had left, hit by a poker across the chest. Kaya saw those rubbed-out stains on the flowered sundress as blood again. He wanted to hug her, fold her into his arms. But as he moved toward her, she hung her head low to the side in profound shyness and backed up. So he simply stepped onto the porch.
"Come in,"
she said, and led him into the small living room, chock-full with her specimens.
"Oh," he said. "Yes, then. I saw your book, Kaya. I didn't know for sure if it was you, but yes, now I can see it was. It's amazing."
He walked around looking at her collections, also examining the room with its new furniture, glancing down the halls to the bedrooms, not wanting to snoop, but taking it all in.
"Do you want coffee? Tea?"
She didn't know if he'd come for a visit or to stay. What did he want after all these years?
"Coffee would be great. Thank you."
In the kitchen, he recognized the old wood stove next to the new gas range and refrigerator. He ran his hand over the old kitchen table, which she had kept as it was, with all its peeling paint history. She poured the coffee in mugs, and they sat.
"You're a soldier, then?"
"Two tours in Nam. I'm staying in the army for a few more months. They've been good to me. Paid for my college degree. Mechanical engineering. Georgia Tech. Least I can do is stay in a while."
Georgia wasn't all that far away. He could have visited sooner. But he was here now.
"You all left,"
she said.
"Pa stayed a while after you, but then he went too. I don't know where.
Don't know if he's alive or not." "You've been here by yourself since then?"
"Yes."
"Kaya, I shouldn't have left you with that monster.
I've ached, felt terrible about it for years. I was a coward, a stupid coward. These damned medals don't mean a thing. He swiped at his chest. I left you, a little girl, alone to survive in a swamp with a madman. I don't expect you to forgive me, ever.
Jody, it's okay. You were just a kid yourself. What could you do?
I could have come back when I was older. At first, it was day-to-day survival on the back streets of Atlanta. He sneered. I left here with 75 cents in my pocket. Stole it from the money Pa left in the kitchen. Took it, knowing it would leave you short. I scraped by on odd jobs till the army took me in. After training, it was straight to war. When I got home, so much time had passed, I figured you were long gone, run away yourself. That's the reason I didn't write. I think I signed up to go back as a kind of self-punishment. What I deserved for leaving you. Then, after I graduated from tech a couple of months ago, I saw your book in a shop. Catherine Danielle Clark. My heart just broke and leapt for joy all at once. I had to find you. Figured I'd start here and track you down.
Well, here we are, then.
She smiled for the first time. His eyes were the same as they had been. Faces change with life's toll, but eyes remain a window to what was, and she could see him there.
Jody, I'm so sorry you worried about leaving me. Not once did I blame you. We were the victims, not the guilty.
He smiled. Thank you, Kaya. Tears welled, and they both looked away. She hesitated, then said,
This may be hard to believe, but for a while, Pa was good to me.
He drank less, taught me to fish, and we went out in the boat a lot, all over the marsh.
But then, of course, he went back to drinking and left me to fend for myself.
Jody nodded. Yeah, I saw that side of him a few times, but he always went back to the bottle. He told me once it had something to do with the war. I've been to war myself and seen things that could drive a man to drink, but he shouldn't have taken it out on his wife, his own kids.
What about Ma? The others? She asked. Did you ever hear from them? Know where they went?
I don't know a thing about Murph, Mandy, or Missy. I wouldn't know them if I passed them in the street. By now, I suppose they've scattered with the wind. But Ma, well, Kaya, that's another reason I wanted to find you. There is some news of her.
Some news? What? Tell me.
Chills flowed from Kaya's arms to her fingertips. Kaya, it's not good. I only found out last week. Ma died 2 years ago. She bent at the waist, holding her face in her hands. Soft groans came from her throat. Jody tried to hold her, but she moved away from him. Jody continued. Ma had a sister, Rosemary, who tried to track us down through the Red Cross when Ma died, but they couldn't find us. Then, a couple of months ago, they found me through the army and put me in touch with Rosemary.
In hoarse tones, Kaya mumbled. Ma was alive until 2 years ago. I've been waiting all these years for her to walk down the lane.
She stood and held on to the sink.
Why didn't she come back? Why didn't somebody tell me where she was? And now it's too late.
Jody went to her, and even though she tried to turn away, he put his arms around her.
I'm sorry, Kaya. Come sit down. I'll tell you what Rosemary said.
He waited for her, then said, Ma was ill from a major breakdown when she left us and went to New Orleans. That's where she grew up. She was mentally and physically ill. I remember New Orleans a little bit. I guess I was 5 when we left. All I remember is a nice house, big windows overlooking a garden. But once we moved here, Pa wouldn't let any of us talk about New Orleans, our grandparents, or any of it. So it was all wiped away.
Kaya nodded. I never knew.
Jody continued. Rosemary said their parents had been against Ma's marriage to Pa from the start, but Ma went off to North Carolina with her husband, not a penny to their names. Eventually, Ma began writing to Rosemary and told her of her circumstances, living in a swamp shack with a drunk man who beat her and her children. Then one day, years later, Ma showed up. She had on those fake alligator heels that she cherished, hadn't bathed or combed her hair in days. For months, Ma was mute, didn't speak one word. She stayed in her old room in her parents' home, barely eating. Of course, they had doctors come out, but no one could help her. Ma's father contacted the sheriff in Barkley Cove to ask if Ma's children were all right, but his office said they didn't even try to keep track of the Marsh people. Kaya sniffed now and then. Finally, almost a year later, Ma became hysterical and told Rosemary she remembered she had left her children. Rosemary helped her write a letter to Pa asking if she could come get us and bring us to live with her in New Orleans. He wrote back that if she returned or contacted any of us, he would beat us unrecognizable. She knew he was capable of such a thing.
The letter in the blue envelope. Ma had asked for her, for all of them. Ma had wanted to see her. But the outcome of the letter had been vastly different. The words had enraged Pa and sent him back to drinking, and then Kaya had lost him as well. She didn't mention to Jody that she still kept the letter's ashes in a little jar.
Rosemary said Ma never made friends, never dined with the family or interacted with anybody. She allowed herself no life, no pleasure. After a while, she started talking more, and all she talked about was her children. Rosemary said, Ma loved us all her life, but was frozen in some horrible place of believing that we'd be harmed if she returned and abandoned if she didn't. She didn't leave us to have a fling. She'd been driven to madness and barely knew she'd left.
Kaya asked, How did she die?
She had leukemia. Rosemary said it was possibly treatable, but she refused all medication. She just became weaker and weaker and slipped away 2 years ago.
Rosemary said she died much as she had lived,
in darkness, in silence.
Jody and Kaya sat still. Kaya thought of the poem by Galway Kinnell that Ma had underlined in her book. I have to say, I am relieved it is over. At the end, I could feel only pity for that urge toward more life. Goodbye. Jody stood.
Come with me, Kaya. I want to show you something.
He led her outside to his pickup, and they climbed into the back. Carefully, he removed a tarp and opened a large cardboard box, and one by one, pulled out and unwrapped oil paintings. He stood them up around the bed of the truck. One was of 3 young girls, Kaya and her sisters, squatting by the lagoon, watching dragonflies. Another of Jody and their brother, holding up a string of fish.
I brought them in case you were still here. Rosemary sent these to me. She said that for years, day and night, Ma painted us.
One painting showed all 5 children as if they were watching the artist. Kaya stared into the eyes of her sisters and brothers, looking back at her.
In a whisper, she asked,
"Who's who?"
"What?"
"There were never any photographs. I don't know them. Who's who?"
"Oh." He couldn't breathe, then finally said, "Well, this is Missy, the oldest. Then Murph, Mandy. Of course, this little cutie is me, and that's you." He gave her time, then said, "Look at this one." Before him was an astonishingly colorful oil of two children squatting in swirls of green grass and wild flowers. The girl was only a toddler, perhaps 3 years old, her straight black hair falling over her shoulders. The boy, a bit older with golden curls, pointed to a monarch butterfly, its black and yellow wings spread across a daisy. His hand was on the girl's arm. "I think that's Tate Walker," Jody said. "And you?"
"I think you're right. It looks like him. Why would Ma paint Tate?"
"He used to come around quite a bit. Fish with me. He was always showing you insects and stuff."
"Why don't I remember that?"
"You were very young. One afternoon, Tate boated into our lagoon where Pa was pulling on his poke, really drunk. You were waiting and Pa was supposed to be watching you. Suddenly, for no reason at all, Pa grabbed you by your arms and shook you so hard your head was thrown back. Then he dropped you in the mud and started laughing. Tate jumped out of the boat and ran up to you. He was only 7 or 8 years old, but he shouted at Pa. Of course, Pa smacked him and screamed at him to get off his land, never come back or he'd shoot him. By this time, we'd all run down to see what was happening. Even with Pa ranting and raving, Tate picked you up and handed you to Ma. He made sure you were all right before he left. We still went fishing some after that, but he never came back to our place again."
"Not until he led me home that first time I took the boat into the marsh," Kaya thought. She looked at the painting, so pastel, so peaceful. Somehow, Ma's mind had pulled beauty from lunacy. Anyone looking at these portraits would think they portrayed the happiest of families, living on a seashore, playing in sunshine. Jody and Kaya sat on the rim of the truck bed, still looking quietly at the paintings. He continued, "Ma was isolated and alone. Under those circumstances, people behave differently." Kaya made a soft groan.
"Please don't talk to me about isolation.
No one has to tell me how it changes a person. I have lived it. I am isolation,"
Kaya whispered with a slight edge.
"I forgive Ma for leaving, but I don't understand why she didn't come back, why she abandoned me. You probably don't remember, but after she walked away, you told me that a she-fox will sometimes leave her kits if she's starving or under some other extreme stress. The kits die, as they probably would have anyway, but the vixen lives to breed again when conditions are better, when she can raise a new litter to maturity. I've read a lot about this since. In nature, out yonder where the crawdads sing, these ruthless-seeming behaviors actually increase the mother's number of young over her lifetime, and thus her genes for abandoning offspring in times of stress are passed on to the next generation, and on and on. It happens in humans, too. Some behaviors that seem harsh to us now ensured the survival of early man in whatever swamp he was in at the time. Without them, we wouldn't be here. We still store those instincts in our genes, and they express themselves when certain circumstances prevail. Some parts of us will always be what we were, what we had to be to survive way back yonder. Maybe some primitive urge, some ancient genes not appropriate anymore,
drove Ma to leave us because of the stress, the horror, and real danger of living with Pa. That doesn't make it right. She should have chosen to stay. But knowing that these tendencies are in our biological blueprints might help one forgive even a failed mother. That may explain her leaving, but I still don't see why she didn't come back, why she didn't even write to me. She could have written letter after letter, year after year, until one finally got to me.
I guess some things can't be explained, only forgiven or not. I don't know the answer. Maybe there isn't one. I'm sorry to bring you this bad news.
I've had no family, no news of family for most of my life. Now, within a few minutes, I've found a brother and lost my mother.
I'm so sorry, Kaya.
Don't be. Actually, I lost Ma years ago. And now you're back, Jody. I can't tell you how much I wanted to see you again. This is one of the happiest and yet saddest days of my life.
She touched his arm with her fingers, and he already knew her enough to know this was rare. They walked back into the shack, and he looked around at the new things, the freshly painted walls, the handcrafted kitchen cabinets.
How'd you manage, Kaya? Before your book, how'd you get money? Food?
Oh, that's a long, boring story. Mostly I sold mussels, oysters, and smoked fish to Jumpin'.
Jody threw his head back and laughed out loud.
Jumpin'? I haven't thought about him for years. Is he still around?
Kaya didn't laugh.
Jumpin' has been my best friend. For years, my only friend. My only family. Unless you count herring gulls.
Jody turned serious.
Didn't you have friends in school?
I only went to school one day in my life,
she chuckled.
The kids laughed at me, so I never went back. Spent weeks outsmarting the truant officers, which after all the things you'd taught me wasn't very hard.
He looked astonished.
How did you learn to read? To write your book?
Actually, it was Tate Walker who taught me to read.
You ever see him anymore?
Now and then.
She stood, faced the stove.
More coffee?
Jody felt the lonely life hanging in her kitchen. It was there in the tiny supply of onions in the vegetable basket, the single plate drying in the rack, the cornbread wrapped carefully in a tea towel, the way an old widow might do it.
I've had plenty, thanks. But what about a ride around the marsh? He asked.
Of course. You won't believe it. I have a new motor, but still use that same old boat.
The sun had broken up the clouds and shone bright and warm for a winter day. As she steered them through narrow channels and glassy estuaries, he exclaimed at a remembered snag, the same as it had been, and a beaver lodge still piled in the exact spot. They laughed when they came to the lagoon where Ma, Kaya, and their sisters had grounded the boat in mud. Back at the shack, she put together a picnic, which they ate on the beach with the gulls.
I was so young when they all left, she said. Tell me about the others.
So he told her stories of their older brother, Murph, who carried her around on his shoulders through the woods.
You used to laugh the whole time. He would jog and turn circles with you way up there. And one time you laughed so hard, you wet your pants right on his neck.
Oh, no, I didn't.
Kaya leaned back, laughing.
Yes, you did. He squealed some, but he kept on going. Ran right into the lagoon until he was underwater, and you still riding his shoulders. We were all watching, Ma, Missy, Mandy, and me, and laughed till we cried. Ma had to sit right down on the ground, she was laughing so hard.
Her mind invented pictures to go with the stories. Family scraps and shreds Kaya never thought she'd have. Jody continued. It was Missy who started feeding the gulls.
What? Really? I thought I started it on my own after everybody left.
No, she fed the gulls every day she could get away with it. She gave them all names. She called one Big Red, I remember that. You know.